Hey everybody, welcome once again to F This Movie, the official podcast of the F This Movie podcast. My name is Patrick Brownlee, and I'm joined tonight for a discussion of James Jim Cameron's Aliens by Eric Asperschlager.
Hello Patrick, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I am also good.
You are excited for a bug hunt, no doubt?
I am down. I am down for, up for a bug hunt. I could be both.
You could be up and down for a bug hunt. This movie should have been called Bug Hunt, and it should have been pitched at children. Remember, as always, you can find all of our past episodes and reviews and lists and articles at fthismovie.net. Make sure that you visit our site. You should like us on Facebook by going to facebook.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. Find us at DVD Verdict by visiting dvdverdict.com and clicking on the podcast tab. And while you're there, you could read one of hundreds of reviews from Eric Asperschlager and myself, as well as several other writers. But really, we're the two you want to focus on. And you can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Did I get everything?
I think so. I spaced out for part of that.
No problem. Feel free to space out for the rest of the episode.
In space, something, something scream.
Ice cream. Something, ooh, something ice cream. Eric, have you seen anything good lately?
I have. It's been a while since I've been on the show, but I'll call out a couple things that I think tie back into what we're talking about tonight.
Can you just catch us up on everything you've seen since the last time you were on?
Yeah, it's pretty much just these two movies.
Oh, cool. Okay.
No, not really. couple things that I think tie in. First up, I revisited Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds.
Okay.
Which is a movie that I saw in the theater and really liked. I remember having a very, very positive experience in the theater. I remember going and being just thrilled and terrified, and the whole thing, or at least the parts I remember, just really caught me up. So much so that I remember leaving the theater, and this is when we lived close enough to our local theater that I could walk there. I remember walking home and kind of looking up above the houses and imagining the tripods kind of hovering over our sleepy little town. I don't know why that image has stuck with me. So whatever it was, it really got me when I saw it. And then after that, because it came, I think, in 2005, and pretty much every time the movie came up after that, when someone would mention it, it would be kind of as a punchline. It would kind of be some sort of a negative thing. So I sort of assumed that, well, maybe it wasn't as good as I thought it was. It was just one of those experiences where you see it at the right place, right time, right mood. But a few weeks back, Devin Faraci of Badass Digest tweeted out that he was writing a defense of the movie and that he really liked it. And so that inspired me to go back and check it out again. So I tracked down a copy, and it is really good. It is still really good. I really like that movie. I think there are some pacing problems for sure, but the first hour, especially, of that movie is as thrilling and exciting and terrifying as I remember, and as thrilling and exciting and terrifying as most anything else I've seen on screen. So I really had a good time going back to it. I felt a little bit vindicated that I'm not just a sheep who goes along with the flashy lights and bright colors. But
yeah, I've always been a fan of that movie, and I agree that it has some problems, especially in the second half. And I read Devin Faraci's article about it, and it was a really good article, and he makes some points that I'm not even 100% sure that I am necessarily on board with, but I can't really argue the points. It's like, well, that's as interesting an argument for some of those choices as I've read, even if I don't totally agree with them. I think it's a great, a convincing argument that he makes, but I've always been a fan of the movie, and I think the stuff that works so well that it overshadows any of the problems that I might have.
Sure. I mean, I think it gets to a point in the movie, and it's so kind of balls to the wall for the first hour that there's no way you can really maintain that for a full 2 hours. So, and if you can, you should probably consult your physician. But just came to me. But anyway, I think the pacing problem of the movie is that it gets to a point where it really slows way down. And then it slows way down, and then it just starts jumping ahead. It feels like they're missing scenes kind of in between the next two or three segments of the movie. It's weird. It's almost like I would like a longer and shorter cut of the movie at the same time.
Yeah,
that kind of evens it all out.
My problem with it was always that it felt like it was just missing the third act, that like we get the crazy and it, you know, that it's way too long for a first act. But like you said, that whole first hour feels like a first act that's crazy, just intense and scary and good. And then it slows down and I'm okay with that. But then by the time we feel like, okay, now it needs to become this other thing, instead the movie just kind of ends.
Yeah. Yeah. But I, as a, like you said, it's so good for so long that I will, I'll certainly revisit it at some point. I thought it, and you know, Tom Cruise is good in it. I know you are a fan of the Cruise Man.
I can be a fan of the Cruise Man. I think it's such an interesting companion piece to like Close Encounters and E.T. You have Steven Spielberg, who makes these three very different alien movies, and just what a dark and sort of bleak movie War of the Worlds is as a flip side of like E.T., you know, which...
Yeah. And on the Tom Cruise, Steven Spielberg front, it makes me want to revisit Minority Report, which is a movie I did not like very much when I saw it. There are parts of it that I enjoyed, but I remember kind of overall being left a bit cold by that movie. So I should revisit it at some point just to give it a second chance.
Yeah, the last time I watched it was for this podcast, and I liked it less than I had. But I think I'm kind of in the minority on that. I mean, that's a movie that people really, really love. So maybe I need to see it again too. I don't know.
Yeah, I probably need to see AI again, because I liked that a lot when I saw it in the theater. And maybe I'm wrong on that. Who knows? I mean, basically what I'm saying is I don't trust myself. I'm a different person now than I was, you know, yeah, 5-6 years ago. I'm literally a different person. You can't tell. This is the internet. How do you know? I could be catfish. But the other movie that I
you could be a catfish.
I could be a cat. I could be a talking catfish. I could be a Pixar movie over here. Bug Hunt. So I don't know. We're gonna get to Alien soon, folks. Don't worry. The other movie that I checked out that is not an alien movie, but it's a space movie. I finally saw Moon, Duncan Jones' Moon.
What did you think of Moon?
I liked it a lot.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that movie.
Yeah, I think the atmosphere, no pun intended, is really great. And considering how little it was made for, it feels like a... It feels like a more expensive movie, although it's exactly the right size for the movie that it wants to be.
Right.
I think there are a lot of movies that have problems with scope and trying to kind of put too much into 2 hours or an hour and a half or whatever it is. I think that movie fits it in nicely. If I had to criticize it at all, and I guess I don't have to, but I'm going to. It's that the twist, which I sort of had you know, heard at some point. I didn't go in, you know, cold, but I'd actually kind of, I guess I'd misheard it or misremembered it, which was nice. The twist, see, I think comes a little too early in the movie. I don't think it's the kind of movie that should be, you know, a Twilight Zone, M. Night Shyamalan last minute thing. I think everything that happens after the twist is really good and really says a lot about the character, but it sort of feels like it's like the first third, and then all of a sudden you have like this back third of the movie that felt to me like it's sort of like the inevitable march to where it was going to go, and there wasn't a whole lot new for the movie to say. But that's a minor nitpick. I really liked it. It's interesting. I was looking up some information about it online, and there is apparently a direct connection between that movie and the first Alien, because the one of the people who worked in the special effects, the models, Bill Pearson, was the supervising model maker on an Alien, so that a lot of the rovers and the harvester and stuff he helped work on. So there you go, direct connection.
Plus, there's a ton of chest bursters in Moon, if memory serves. But it's been a few years since I've seen it.
It's mostly chest bursting.
Okay.
which is a weird subset of slash fic I would not recommend people.
have you seen Source Code yet?
That's the weirdest thing you could possibly. It's not the weirdest
it's
thing.
It's definitely not the weirdest thing. No,
it's weird because I just took that out of the library like yesterday or the day before. Okay. I have not had a chance to watch yet. It's sitting. I said, oh, I remember hearing good things about Source Code. I should watch that movie. And Patrick's going to ask me about it. this is almost as weird as last night playing Battleship with my wife, where we sank each other's ships in the exact same order.
Wow. That's beautiful, though. That's, I know. That's the way you want it to go, you know?
Right. Love is a battlefield.
You should try watching Battleship with your wife. And
Well, we can turn off at the exact same moment.
And then you'll wish that you could just sink into the ocean. Yeah, Source Code has a lot of stuff in it that I like, too. I wanted to like it because I was such a fan of Moon. I was so excited for the next movie from Duncan Jones. And I wanted to like it a little bit more than I did. But I'll be curious to hear your thoughts on it. It's good. It's good. I don't mean to undersell it, but...
No. That's good. Up until right now, I didn't realize that it was a Duncan Jones movie. I probably did when it came out, but I hadn't seen Moon, so yeah. It didn't, you know,
connect. So now you see that my question actually makes more sense. It's not just completely random that I asked, have you seen Source Code?
It's not just because of the webcams you have hidden throughout my house.
That's exactly right. I saw a movie called The FP, which is a movie that came out, I think, in 2011 or 2012, and it's a movie that was put out by Drafthouse Films, which is sort of a smaller boutique label that's run by the Alamo Drafthouse in Austin, Texas, and Tim League. And it's a movie, it's sort of a parody of these future post-apocalyptic competitive sport movies that were very popular in like the 80s. It's a very specific parody, and it's good at being that thing, but instead of the competitive sport being like whatever the sport was in like the Blood of Heroes, I can't remember what that was, but it's Dance Dance Revolution, that's the big sport of the future, and rival gangs compete against one another in Dance Dance Revolution, and every fourth word is like a variation on a curse word, and it has some funny moments and some good ideas, but it's the kind of movie that almost seems engineered ahead of time to be a cult movie, and I think that's a really hard thing to do. Cult movies tend to happen by accident. It's the audience that determines what a cult movie is when you try and sort of prefabricate that thing. It's usually pretty transparent. Having said that, the very end of the movie, again, literally the last shot in the movie, is so funny that, once again, it's almost worth recommending the entire movie. It's sort of a twist on the moment where the, you know, I guess spoilers sort of for the FP coming up, where the guy and the girl finally have their moment and get together at the end of every movie. This movie kind of puts its own spin on that, and it's such a funny beat that, once again, it's almost worth sitting through the whole movie, but I don't know that I can recommend it. I think there's an audience for the movie, I just don't know if I'm it. And then the last thing that I saw and will recommend is a movie that was recommended to me, I believe, by Mark on this podcast. And again, I believe in our Netflix This Movie column, and that is Everything or Nothing, the documentary about the James Bond series that's available on Netflix Instant. It's, you know, it's pretty good. It's fairly candid. There's so much ground to cover. They have to cover 50 years in 90 minutes. That it's not exactly comprehensive, but, you know, Pierce Brosnan is pretty forthright about what it was like to get and then lose and then get and then lose the gig as Bond. And Timothy Dalton is pretty forthcoming about what he thinks might be went wrong with his entries. And if nothing else, the movie kind of cleared up some of that Thunderball, never say never again business that has never made much sense to me. How there were, for a time, there were these two basically rival James Bond series going on because different people had the rights to different properties. And so it kind of clears that up. And if nothing else, I walked away from it wanting to go back and rewatch every James Bond movie, which is good and bad. You know, it's good because they're a lot of fun and I like James Bond, and it's bad because I should be watching other stuff. I just watched way too many James Bond movies back in November when Skyfall came out. So
How many did you watch? What was the percentage, at least, or total?
I had to have watched at least half, possibly more. There were several like pretty terrible ones that I did skip back back in November, but I watched a whole bunch and then have gradually kind of picked away since then. Like, I just rewatched for the first time in a long time, because I didn't watch it back in November. I rewatched License to Kill, the second Timothy Dalton movie that has a lot of problems. It feels a lot like an episode of Miami Vice and not as much like a James Bond movie, but I still enjoy certain aspects of it.
Is that the cello one?
That is not the cello one. That's Living Daylights. That one I actually really like. License to Kill is Robert Davi as like the drug dealer.
Oh yeah, yeah. I watched both of the Dalton ones in my brief Bond. You know, we were all doing Bond at the time. Yeah. It was very popular. I know that.
When I was a kid, I was
judge each other.
When I was a kid, I was positive that License to Kill was the superior movie because it has more action, it's more violent, and I was, you know, 9 or whatever. And Living Daylights, to me, was kind of boring because it was all spies and people skiing or sledding in cello cases and stuff. And now, as an incredibly mature adult, I definitely prefer Living Daylights over License to Kill.
Taking a bold stance.
I am. Listen. That's how I do on this podcast.
Podcast of bold stances.
Speaking of bold stances that perhaps we should not be taking, let's discuss Aliens from 1986. James Cameron's sequel to Ridley Scott's classic space horror movie. This is a podcast that we've been bouncing around for some time, possibly going back to Scary Movie Month in October. And the reason for that is because you, at least at the time, were of an opinion of Aliens that is not necessarily the prevailing opinion on Aliens. Do you want to start us off here?
Well, I'll tell you, I have a complicated relationship with Aliens. That was made even more complicated last night when I rewatched the movie. And I think I first saw it in college. I think I saw Alien maybe in high school, and you know, really liked the Alien. My first experience with the first Alien was through my father, who had apparently rented it one night when we were away. I don't know where we were, so I'm a little suspicious of his story, but he says that we were away and he rented it and he didn't know anything about it, and he rented it and he said it was the scariest thing he'd ever seen. And then I watched it and I loved it. Sometime in college, someone had Aliens on videotape, and I watched it, and I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever seen. I thought it was, you know, badass and exciting, and just, you know, at the time I was like super into it, and I was just probably a lot of, you know, testosterone and stuff. It was, you know, it was college, so who knows? And I really, really liked it, and it had been a long time after that. You know, I probably watched it a few times in college. Then there was a long break, and then I rewatched it for the first time in a long time when I got the Alien Anthology, I think 2 Christmases ago. And I didn't really like it all that much. I mean, I liked it. It was okay, but it just seemed like it was kind of loud and dumb, and the dialogue was not great, and the characters were thinly drawn. And I, you know, I think that's when I first, you know, put out my controversial stance that Aliens was not a very good movie. And I also have a complicated relationship with James Cameron, as anyone who followed my tweets during the at this movie fest can attest. But rewatching Aliens last night, expecting to come away with the same opinion, I actually liked it a lot. So I don't know where I am. This is a weird litmus test of a movie, and I'm trying to figure out why. And part of it, I think, is talking with you about kind of James Cameron in general. You're kind of talking me down off a ledge because there's something about James Cameron as a filmmaker that is kind of at odds with my own personal sensibilities. Mm-hmm. I think that he paints in such broad strokes that characters are more kind of ideas than they are kind of these living, breathing people, that the dialogue can be silly, that, you know, that he knows how to structure a movie and make it easily, you know, understood by almost anyone. At the same time that I, you know, at times I felt like he's a sacrificed character to do that. I have not seen Titanic since I saw it in the theater, but I hated that movie. There was a time when I really loved James Cameron's movies. I remember really liking The Abyss, and that's a movie I need to rewatch at some point because I've heard good things about it, and I expect that it would still hold up. But just kind of in general, I never saw Avatar. Like it's kind of the sense that, okay, James Cameron and I, we can probably part ways. We don't really have to, you know, have a whole lot to do with each other. But, you know, through talking with you about James Cameron, and even rewatching Terminator 2 during this movie, which is a movie I'm still not – there's still large parts of it that I don't like. But kind of watching it with a festival crowd, with appreciative people, I was able to kind of cut through my own prejudices and I think enjoy it on a larger and enjoy it, you know, larger than – more than I had before.
Yeah.
Now, I'm trying to figure out why Aliens is a movie that I didn't like 2 years ago but like now. And I think what it comes down to is when I didn't like Aliens with the Alien Anthology, it was because I just watched Alien.
Mm-hmm.
And I think watching those two back-to-back, Aliens is such a different movie. And if you don't come in kind of already knowing what to expect, and it had been a while since I'd seen it, it's pretty jarring. And I think that you know, you get such great performances and, you know, characters and this, the horror movie vibe of Alien, that when you get in with Aliens, it does seem loud and dumb and, you know, full of machismo and all these things that I'm not necessarily always drawn to in movies. And so, you know, a lot of the stuff that people like about it, a lot of the, you know, the Colonial Marine chatter and Bill Paxton and all those things that people like, I, you know, was really annoyed by when I watched it. This time I watched it soon after rewatching The Dark Knight Rises, which I think made Aliens seem better to me because The Dark Knight Rises has almost no structure to it at all, and it's almost like the opposite of what James Cameron, you know, does with his movie. And this again, this we talked about in an email thread, and you were right, I was wrong, but you know, The Dark Knight Rises is just all over the place. Nolan in that movie doesn't know what he wants to do. And then you watch Aliens and you see such a clear, you know, a clear story that just is propelled from one scene to the next. And you always know where you are. You always know what's at stake. You always know, you know, what everyone represents at a scene. And there's excitement and there's, you know, thrills and there's aliens and there's guns. And it's, I enjoyed it a lot more, I think, for what it was. I was able to meet it on its own terms. And I liked it. So I think that there are still things that James Cameron-y things that I will never quite be able to get on board with, but I was at least caught up with it this time.
Okay.
So this is going to be a boring podcast.
No, not at all. Where do I start? I could totally understand watching it after Alien, why you would have that reaction, because it really is in so many ways, I mean, the exact opposite of Alien. And the movies are always sort of pitted against one another, more so than really any other, you know, movie and sequel I can think of, except maybe Godfather and Godfather Part 2, which isn't even fair because those are made by the same filmmaker, you know, if nothing else. And in most instances, it's sort of a foregone conclusion. Well, the original is better than the sequel. And with the Alien franchise, you know, disregarding 3 and 4, and those movies have their fans, and that's fine. But basically, the conversation comes down to Alien versus Aliens. And there's this camp that likes this movie, and there's this camp that likes this movie. And they are so different that I almost think it's unfair to compare the two. Having said that, I mean, I would completely agree that, like, the original Alien is a better movie. It's just, it's better made, it's much more subtle, the characterization is much more interesting, it's very beautiful, it's paced really, really well. Everything about that movie kind of works. Having said that, if I'm going to watch one of them, in most instances, I'll watch Aliens only because it gives me more of what I kind of want out of a movie. I like James Cameron in theory, and I like the majority of his movies. I haven't seen Titanic in a long time. Like you, I haven't seen The Abyss in a long time, and I keep waiting for them to put out a better version because I don't feel like watching my non-anamorphic DVD. I'm not the biggest True Lies fan, but I like both Terminator movies, and my relationship with Avatar is well documented on this podcast. And and I'm a big fan of Aliens. And what I like about James Cameron is one of the things that I like about Christopher Nolan that you brought up, which is it's rare to have a writer-director. You know, usually when people talk about writer-director, the person that comes to mind is, you know, Woody Allen or Kevin Smith or maybe, you know, Quentin Tarantino. They are sort of making smaller, maybe artsier movies. But with James Cameron and Christopher Nolan, you have writer-directors who are working on this massive blockbuster scale. And I've always liked that, especially about James Cameron, because obviously his movies are very much his movies for better and worse. And I absolutely see the flaws in Aliens, and I think there are a lot of the things that rubbed you the wrong way the last time you watched it. I've been having this conversation more and more lately, and it might have come up on a recent podcast, I don't remember, where you have a situation where you see a movie from a director, and it strikes you in such a way that it forces you to reevaluate a lot of that director's past work. And I've always liked Aliens a lot, but after seeing Avatar, and the problems with James Cameron are on display, I think, in Avatar more than in any other movie. Like, everything that's wrong with James Cameron is front and center in Avatar. But, I mean, everything that's sort of right about him, too. So it's an interesting movie in that respect. But seeing Avatar and the way that certain things about that movie that don't work, the dialogue, the characterization, the sort of thinness of the ideas, they're so front and center that you go back and watch Aliens and you realize, oh, all that same stuff is in this movie. And for some reason we were overlooking it. And maybe it's because it's disguised a little bit better by the Sigourney Weaver performance or by just sort of the forward momentum and the relentless sort of intensity of the movie, because like War of the Worlds, which you brought up earlier, I think Aliens does so much right that I'm able to overlook the things that annoy me. And for the most part, the things that annoy me are the Marine dialogue. Because Sigourney Weaver's dialogue doesn't really annoy me. I like Paul Reiser. I think he's managed to create a couple sort of three-dimensional characters in this movie that he didn't, you know, later on in Avatar. That movie is all just sort of types. And in Aliens, I think you've got Sigourney Weaver and Paul Reiser and Lance Henriksen and even Michael Biehn to an extent to sort of carry you through the rest of the really over-the-top. I mean, I know Bill Paxton's performance has a lot of fans. I have never really liked it. I just think it's so cartoony and so at odds with the tone of the rest of the movie that I can't even really find it funny, because the movie is so just relentlessly intense. And then you have this guy bugging his eyes and like joking around. And again, I know he's supposed to be the comic relief, but that's more than anything, I think, where Cameron falls flat is when he tries to be funny in every one of his movies. And that is personified in the Bill Paxton performance. Having said that, I'm still a really, really big fan of the movie, and watching it this time reminded me why, because the stuff that works, I think, works so, so well. I think Cameron is a great filmmaker and a mediocre to bad writer.
I agree. I think that you hit on something that's important. I think that one of the reasons that this movie works so well is because of Sigourney Weaver's character, which does not originate with Cameron. Now, he certainly put his own twist on the character. I think that she is different in this movie than in the first Alien. And, you know, his spin on her, it's been a while since I've seen 3 and 4, but I'm kind of informed the way that she was drawn from that point onward. I think even the way she's remembered as a, you know, an action movie heroine, mm-hmm. she does her stuff in the first movie, but you know, she's far more of a, you know, a force to be reckoned with, in this movie. So he starts with a, you know, kind of someone else's framework, And again, it's a very different movie than the first Alien. But you know, with Ridley Scott, you have this, you know, this world with Edgar Geiger. You have the creatures. You have this kind of framework, and you have this character Ripley that was brought over. So he had a place to start with. Ripley is, by you know, far and away, I think, the most three-dimensional and interesting character in the movie. Had he, you know, created his own heroine, you know, whole cloth, who knows if that, you know, would have been the case.
It probably would have been, you know, Vasquez, you know, which
sure
is not great.
Exactly. And it's interesting to watch this movie. Another part of the ongoing James Cameron dialogue that we're having is, I think back in October, I reviewed the Terminator anthology box set.
Yeah.
And revisiting Terminator, all the Terminator movies, but Terminator 1 and 2 especially, I was surprised at how much less I liked them now than when I had seen them before. Even the first Terminator movie, which I think it's impressive what he's able to do with, you know, a limited budget and all those kinds of things. But I think that the Terminator series is very problematic for me because there's not a whole lot to it. I mean, it's pretty thin. You have this sense of what's happening in the future world where all this interesting machine versus man war is going on, and you see, you know, these brief snippets of, I don't know, machines crush skulls because of the future. But other than that, it's people running around Los Angeles. And I know I'm reducing both the Terminator movies far more than they should be reduced, but you know, it seems to me there's not a whole lot. I know movies have their fans. Whereas like Alien and Aliens has at least it's set in the future. At least you kind of have all this great design and work. It feels like more to me. And I think that Alien does such a good job of establishing all of it. Then we get to the Aliens. James Cameron has a lot to start with. So I think that sort of hybrid filmmaking approach helps him a lot and makes it a much stronger movie.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've always liked about James Cameron, and again, I sometimes like the idea of James Cameron more than I like James Cameron, but one of the things that I've always liked about him is his insistence on challenging himself almost every time out, whether it's Terminator 2, where he's going to make the biggest movie. You know, a lot of times the challenge is, well, I'm going to make the biggest movie ever made, but it's introducing new technologies, new special effects, recreating not just the crash of the Titanic, but the actual, you know, ship of the Titanic and shooting inside this giant water tank. And that his challenge with Aliens was, you know, he sees the original Alien and he had been lobbying for the job to direct the sequel since he was working on the Terminator and was promised the gig if the Terminator worked out, and obviously it did, so he was able to then go make Aliens. But to see Alien and then say, okay, I'm going to do a sequel, but I'm going to take it in a completely different direction and not just change, you know, sort of the story and some of the characterization, as you pointed out with Ripley, but change the genre of the movie. And I can't think of many sequels that have ever done that, where the first movie is sort of this gothic horror movie in space, and then Cameron comes on and says, okay, I'm going to take the same framework, the same characters, the same villains, but I'm going to make basically a Vietnam combat film on this massive scale. And again, I think that's part of what turns some people off, because they like the intimacy of the first movie, and the second movie is so just loud and obnoxious, and there's a lot of aliens instead of just one. But I really admire the way that he challenges himself, and more often than not, as far as I'm concerned, succeeds.
Yeah. No, I totally see that now. I think that once I can kind of look beyond, and this is a challenge that I have, in watching a lot of movies and especially in reviewing movies, is to really kind of look beyond my initial gut reaction with the movie and kind of consider what it is that the director has done, what the people who works on the movie have done, and just the work that goes into making a movie, mm-hmm. good or bad. I was able to watch a few of the special features on Aliens before we recorded. So, you know, and that I think does a great job of showing just how kind of exacting and intensive the process was, and just how much thought James Cameron put into the whole thing. I think it definitely shows up on screen. I think it's a very distinctive looking movie, and again, it can't be understated that it's a movie where it's an action movie where you know what's going on at all times and where everyone is, mm-hmm. and that is so rare, especially in modern action movies where they can just be big and loud. Aliens is big, it is loud, but it also makes a lot of sense. It does a lot of clever things to kind of let you know where everyone is. I noticed this time the scene where the Marines go in and first encounter I don't know if it's a nest exactly, but where all the colonists are being strung up to mm-hmm. Make more aliens. And there's back of the command center inside the armored vehicle, they have a readout for each one of the soldiers that shows their vital signs and stuff. And as soldiers get picked off, their vital signs go flat, and then you can see directly, what's happening to whom. But it doesn't feel like someone is just spouting exposition at you. They are, you're seeing this cue, this visual cue that ramps up the tension, which is pretty great. I'm curious. I know the last time I watched Aliens, I watched the special edition, and this time we decided that we were going to watch just the theatrical cut. And looking at some of the deleted scenes and kind of reading about it, because I couldn't quite remember what all the differences were, I think that there are a few changes in the theatrical version that may have explained at least partly why I liked it better this time. It sounds like there is a bit more Marine stuff in the extended edition, and that I actually liked the Marine stuff more this time, only because it shows a certain type of kind of bravado and arrogance that gets undercut. Mm-hmm. I think what may be problematic later on is that, once that's undercut, the surviving Marines, especially Bill Paxton's character, doesn't really change. He kind of maintains that same kind of cartoonishness, whereas maybe Hicks takes it back a notch. Although Hicks isn't really a big he's not spouting off any of the catchphrases and stuff early on. But
right.
And there's also there's a scene in the special edition that's before they even go that shows Newt and her family approaching the derelict spacecraft and mm-hmm. then bringing the facehugger back, which seems crazy to put back in the movie because that kind of takes away the whole suspense and surprise of kind of figuring out what happened and that the company sent them there to actually check out the spacecraft. Not that big secret. The first movie, same time, that kind of it's a nice kind of build and reveal with the Paul Reiser character later on. It seems like it'd be undermined by seeing that so early in the film.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there are people who complain about some of the pacing of the movie, that it takes too long to really get going. I actually don't necessarily agree with that criticism, because I think it's very deliberate in how long it takes before it lets loose, because then once it lets loose, it never stops. To a point where it does that great thing that James Cameron has done before. He does it in Terminator 2, but Aliens is always the movie I point to where you think it's over at a certain point, and you finally sort of allow yourself to relax, and then there's one more big thing, set piece on the end of the movie that's part of, I think, the greatness of the movie's structure. But a lot of the material that you're talking about that got cut out, is in that first half of the movie, and it would only slow down the pacing more. I 100% agree with you that the scenes with Newt's family, that doesn't work. That part of what's great about Aliens to me is the way that it picks up from the first movie, where Sigourney Weaver is waking up and we're not privy to any, everything that has happened off camera. And if we get to see some of it, then like you said, the reveal, even though we know what's in store, that reveal is kind of spoiled. And it kind of speaks to part of my problem, and not to get on this movie, but with Prometheus, which is just, it explains things that we don't want explained, because the mystery of it, the reveal of that mystery, is part of the appeal, especially in the first Alien, where you see the space jockey sitting in the chair and you're like, oh my gosh, what is that? I don't understand what I'm seeing, but it's so intriguing. And then Prometheus spends 2 hours trying to explain, well, here's what this is. That Aliens does that in a very short amount of time. And so I'm glad that they cut that out. And one of the other big things that got cut out, which I think everybody knows by now, is a mention that Sigourney Weaver, Ellen Ripley's character, had a daughter and then went into hypersleep or whatever for 57 years and wakes up and her daughter is now dead. And that's tragic and it informs the character and that's all fine and good. But to me, that changes the dynamic of her relationship with Newt so much and changes her motivation as a character so much, even though I think in both the extended and the theatrical cut, that motivation is rooted in sort of a maternal instinct. But I think it changes it so much to know that she had this daughter that she now lost, because now it's just about, okay, well, this time I'm going to do it right, and I'm trying to save Newt, but really she's the stand-in for this daughter that I didn't get to see or raise or whatever. Versus just having those things be natural to her without her having a pre-existing daughter that we now know about. I think it works better knowing that, or not knowing that she had a daughter. That's a long way of me saying I really prefer the theatrical cut.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way. One of the things that I noticed when I saw that was in the deleted scenes, and I remember that from the special edition, was that, oh, I wish they had left that in with her daughter, because it did, you know, does tie in with Newt. But I think that as someone who, you know, prefers subtlety over bluntness, I can definitely see what you're saying. The Newt character, and I don't know if there's more of her in the special edition, because again, that she was one of the things that I had problems with when I watched it a couple of years ago. And it's not fair to lump her in with you know, Edward Furlong and Terminator 2, but again, like bringing in this you know, child character that has to be saved and kind of has this I don't know, that ups the stakes in a way that, you know, I feel this extra responsibility for, that I kind of wish they could just get on with it. I think Newt worked better this time, and maybe there's just less of her than I remember. I think that, you know, there's still some kind of ridiculous dialogue stuff. You know, the whole whatever she says, they died okay, or which she delivers in the same way that that kid does in the 80s drug commercial about I learned it from watching you. But it's, you know, it's that kind of James Cameron-y type stuff, the screaming kid, that, you know, obviously there to get the, you know, to get the, you know, raise the stakes, get the audience kind of on, you know, involved and stuff. But I just sort of, it seems a little kind of pandering and transparent to me at times. Although, like I said, she worked for me better this time, maybe because the movie in general worked better for me.
Yeah, I would agree with that she is one of the things that definitely could be wrong with the movie. She's never bothered me as much as, say, John Connor in Terminator 2, because I just think she serves more of a function as sort of a foil to Ripley, more so than John Connor, maybe because he's so much at the center of Terminator 2, and because the movie is really about his relationship with the Schwarzenegger robot. Whereas in Aliens, Newt is a function of, she's just there to sort of inform the Ripley character, so it doesn't bother me as much. But I absolutely agree that he tends to write some hacky dialogue for kids. And I want to go back to something that you had said about the way that the movie undercuts some of that military machismo. And I totally agree with that. And that's actually one of the things that I kind of like, even though I would argue, you know, that Aliens is very much a pro-military movie in the way that it sort of fetishizes weaponry and combat and that oorah attitude. I mean, everything that the sergeant, I think his name is Apone, says is just obnoxious when they're waking up, and he automatically just goes into this speech. And I've never been in the Marine Corps, and I, you know, maybe that's the way it really is. I have no idea, but there's something about the way James Cameron does it, because again, it very much comes up in Avatar. I mean, so many of those scenes are like directly mirrored in Avatar. And the interesting thing in Avatar is that the military now is are almost the villains in that movie. And in some ways, Avatar is like a remake of Aliens, but told from the aliens' perspective.
Right.
Except that, you know, the Na'vi are blue and beautiful as opposed to these just awful bugs. But it's very much sort of the same movie as told from the perspective of the aliens. So it's obviously, you know, it's kind of this pro-military movie. But yeah, like you said, he sets up all these Marines. And, you know, they're not bad guys. They're just there to do a job. It's really sort of the Carter Burks and the corporations of the world that are the villains in Aliens. And, of course, the aliens. but, yeah, he does kind of undercut that by taking out almost all of the Marines in the first big set piece of the movie. And I think that's very clever. And I really like where that leaves the rest of the characters.
Yeah.
Except for Hudson, of course, cause he's the worst.
Yeah. I'd forgotten that, so many of the Marines, get, taken out in that first big scene. And I think it really is a great scene for that reason, because it does show just how, you know, devastating these aliens are, and really kind of, you know, illustrate, you know, Ripley's point when she's arguing in the boardroom at the beginning that, you know, just one of these things comes through, it's going to, you know, wipe out everybody. And in the first movie, I think I always forget that there was just the one alien in that first movie.
Yeah.
And this one you have hordes of, you know, aliens. You see them on the readout that shows, you know, the, well, what you call it exactly, but the, you know, the movement detector dealy.
Yeah.
That's the official tech term for it. You know, you see just this mass of white dots just, you know, bearing down on them.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to look at the aliens in this movie compared to the alien in the first movie, because, you know, James Cameron did put his own spin on even the design of these creatures, to make them, you know, fit more his own aesthetic. And the addition of the alien queen, which I don't think was referenced at all in the first Alien movie. And I'm not exactly sure how that ties into what was revealed in Prometheus, but I guess
we'll
find out Prometheus too. But I guess that's sort of weird too, because like where does the queen come from? When, you know, how was that created? I mean, it's such a cool idea. And fits the kind of bigger feeling of aliens that you don't really question it, but at the same time, where did that queen come from? How does that work? I don't know how it works.
Yeah, no, it doesn't necessarily make sense, but part of that is because we're applying things that we learned in subsequent movies to right. wonder how that works, because really we don't know, we know very little about the aliens by the time we get even to the end of the second movie. And so I tend to just go with it, but yeah, I love that whole idea that he again really tried to come up with ways to, how can I push this forward, how can I push this in different directions. When I was a kid, there's a museum in Chicago called the Museum of Science and Industry, and they did a special effects exhibit, and so they had the real like werewolf from American Werewolf in London. They had some like the dog creatures from Ghostbusters, like the models. Then they had a separate room that you went into, and inside the separate room was a mannequin styled to look like Ripley inside of that big yellow robot loader thing, like the real size thing. And then one of the full-scale models of the alien queen inside this room. And the room was black except a kind of a strobe light going on. And in the corner, they had a little monitor with the scene playing on a loop of the fight between the two of them. And it was amazing how in real life, and maybe it was because of the strobe light or the sound, but in real life, even though it was just a model, how scary that alien queen still was. Mm-hmm. I was young, so maybe that plays a part in it too, but I can still remember being really scared in that room, just at the size of that thing and the design of it, how scary it was. And it's a testament to Stan Winston's work in the movie. You had said before that there were, you know, this movie introduces tons of aliens, and James Cameron sort of turns them into more like insects than in the first movie, where it's this sort of sleek, a guy in a suit, basically. When they shot the movie, they had only, I believe, 6 alien puppets or costumes. You know, basically they were working with 6 xenomorphs. So it's just a testament, again, to sort of the cleverness of the photography and the editing, that it makes it seem like there are so many, when really they shot the movie with only 6 of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things I like about the Aliens movies and the xenomorphs is that they are very adaptable and fluid. And the movies make that more clear, I think, in the later movies, especially in Alien 3, when you maybe see more explicitly that the alien will take on the characteristics of its host. So, you know, you get that dog alien and that kind of thing. Yeah. So I think that that's one of the things about the movies in general that allow them to be a little bit more imaginative. And that's why you can have something like the Alien Queen and not question it, because that could just be kind of an adaptation,
right,
to help the species survive. And it's one of the things that I didn't mind in Prometheus was that – and one of the reasons why I almost buy – when Ridley Scott says that it's not a direct prequel, but more another story set in the universe, is that the things that are revealed in that movie that tie directly to the Alien movies, the old ones, basically all have to do with the space jockeys. Everything that seems to me that's revealed about the nature of the aliens themselves could be just one step in the evolutionary process, or just show how they come about in this specific set of circumstances, if mm-hmm. you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So even like the when we actually see a xenomorph in that movie, it's not the same as in these movies because it comes from a different place.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what I mean in that, you know, that we're not going to talk about that movie, because that movie has its own strengths and problems. And I think to at least to Prometheus's credit, it follows in the footsteps of the previous Alien movies, and that it is a very different kind of genre than these other ones. It's a more kind of poetic, dreamlike thing that, you know, maybe dissolves as soon as you look at it twice. But at least it's not another Alien, and it's not another Aliens, and thankfully it's not another Alien 3. Although I don't know. In Alien 3 is a movie. The first time I saw it, I hated it. When I watched it as part of Alien Anthology, I liked it better. I think maybe I watched the assembly cut. Mm-hmm. Although, like, now watching Aliens and realizing what happens after the end of Aliens, and, you know, seeing how the movie ends with everyone, you know, Ripley and Newt and Hicks, you know, and Bishop being saved, and they get sent off, and it seems like everything's going to be fine. All of a sudden, to start the next movie with everyone except her dying,
yeah,
seems like a real kick in the gut.
Yeah, no, it's completely inexcusable. I think there are things to like in Alien 3. Again, I think that movie definitely has its fans, and I also think there's a subset of people who like really want to be the defenders of Alien 3, and so, you mm-hmm. know, the way that some of us just tend to adopt these little underdog movies, like, no, it's way better than you think, and here's why. I think there's definitely things to like in Alien 3. I think there are things to like in Alien Resurrection, honestly. And one of the things that I've always liked about the series, even though I think they're of wildly varying quality, is the way that each installment is so different from one another, and they bring on a filmmaker each time who has a completely different take on the material. And so no two of them are really very similar, and I'm really only speaking again about the first 4. I guess I could extend that to Prometheus, even though, again, you're talking about Ridley Scott doing 2 movies. What I mean to say is I do not include the Alien versus Predator movies, because why would I? So I think there are things to like in all 4 of them. For me, as far as the story is concerned, I think Aliens ties up Ripley's story very nicely. I think it provides closure, and as far as the story is concerned, those are the only 2 movies in my head that sort of exist. Everything after that is just like, hey, here's another crazy possible version of an Alien movie. Because where it takes the Ripley character, where it takes Hicks and Newt and Bishop, to me is truly inexcusable, because I do grow to care about those characters in in Aliens, which again is, I think, a testament to some of what Cameron is able to pull off. Again, his dialogue is so cartoonish a lot of times, and some of the performances are so over the top. But there is a central group of characters that I think are basically rooted in reality, and whose survival I am invested in. And I guess the movie gets that because they're the characters that survive. You know, I'm not really invested in Hudson's survival, and the movie must understand that because it eventually does get rid of him.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you know, it's weird because I realize this kind of only after the fact, but one of the things that I think the movie doesn't do very well is deal with Bishop's character. Not a lot happens with him.
Yeah.
I think Lance Henriksen is great. But you know, you get this early scene where you know, Ripley reacts to him being an android, and she's obviously very put off by it because of what happened in the first movie. But then after that, he's kind of apart from everyone else, and then he goes off on his own mission to you know, set up the beacon and call down the ship, you know, which just, you know, has to suspend attached to it because you don't know if he's going to do it or not. And then later on, with him piloting the ship and you know, coming back to pick up Ripley, he's just sort of there to kind of shuttle people around, mm-hmm. and provide some information. It's hard to see him as having any kind of real arc. He's just sort of there. I guess in the end, he shows that synthetics aren't all bad, but he does save Newt. But I sort of wish that they'd done a little bit more with that character, especially kind of with Ripley. So it was more than just "you're valuable because you saved me" or "came back for me" or whatever it was.
Sure. Yeah, no, I agree with that. Because the movie does seem interested in taking things that were established in the first movie and then pushing them in different directions, it definitely seems like Cameron is looking to subvert or just tweak what Ridley Scott established in the first movie as far as synthetics are concerned. And I do wish, like you said, that he had paid a little bit more attention to Bishop, because the movie is so good at building tension, and there are moments where, you know, mostly because it is Lance Henriksen and he's played so many kind of bad guys in the past, and he's played good guys as well. He's a cop in the first Terminator, so Cameron has used him as a hero before, but maybe it's just my own baggage. I'm so used to seeing him play a villain that when he shows up as the synthetic, you don't quite trust him because of what the first movie sets up, because he's being played by Lance Henriksen, who is just sort of already intimidating, or just you're not quite sure about him. And so I wish maybe that the movie would have pushed that a little bit further as a way of establishing yet another kind of tension that we're never quite sure what to make of Bishop. And so that at the end, you know, his quote unquote redemption is a little more earned because he ends up being this good guy. And there was never really any doubt. I mean, any thoughts we might have to the contrary just boil down to like a misunderstanding, you know, like, oh, he blew us off. Nope. Wait, sorry. No, he's right over there.
Yeah. They sort of start the character off down that path. There's a scene where he's dissecting the facehugger where you seem like he's a little too in awe of this, you know, horrifying creature. And then that's kind of quickly diffused as soon as he, you know, spills the beans and says that Burke was the one who gave him explicit orders to, you know, keep the specimens alive and all these mm-hmm. things. Like, he basically narcs on Burke and turns into this, you know. So he's really just kind of there to kind of keep pushing things in one direction or the other, but he doesn't have a whole lot of presence, you know, or doesn't have a lot to do himself.
Right. If nothing else, though, his presence in the movie, I think, is worth it because
we
get to that, you know, not only because I like Lance Henriksen as an actor, but also because he gives us that great moment at the end, which is just crazy. Again, we sort of, in our heads, the movie has wrapped up, and then we get the great beat where, you know, spoilers for Aliens, but I'm guessing you guys have seen it. That thing bursts through his chest, and for just a half second you think, oh gosh, he was impregnated, and then it's like, oh no, that's the tale of the monstrous alien queen, and then he is split in half, and it's just, it's a crazy, crazy sight, and it really comes across as so violent, and then you realize, like, oh, it's just a robot, and oh, that white stuff, that's not blood, you know, but the way that it's handled is so brutal, that moment alone to me makes Bishop's appearance worth it.
Yeah, I think that that whole final sequence is great, although I've always hated Ripley's final line to the Queen. Or actually, it's not the final line to the Queen, but when
get
she
away
says,
from her,
you bitch. Yeah. I hate that line.
With good reason. That's Cameron indulging his worst instincts.
Yeah, and that is a line that is repeated almost verbatim in too many movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll never quite be okay with that, but whatever. It's James Cameron. I mean, it's another example of that kind of dialogue that, you know, didn't bother me as much this time. I have to say, I expected to come on this podcast and you know, for there to be a real kind of a showdown about this movie, but
one of the problems I've always had with that line, and I may end up getting hammered for this, but to me, the movie and several of James Cameron's movies are kind of feminist and progressive in the way that he sets up very strong female characters and he gets accused of basically making them strong by turning them into men. But I do not agree with that assessment. I mean, I understand that Sarah Connor in Terminator 2 has transformed herself into sort of this very tough thing. And Ripley certainly is tough in Aliens, but you know, it's the experience of the first movie that has sort of hardened her. She's still very maternal in her relationship with Newt. I don't think that he makes her tough by making her masculine in Aliens. So I feel like the movie is kind of feminist in that way. And then every time, and I understand she's relating to an alien queen, and she might as well be relating to a spider or something. You know, it's not like she's talking woman to woman. But I just feel like any time a woman refers to another woman as a bitch, it's like, you're setting yourself back a little bit. It's such a stupid comment. And I
agree.
I'm sure I'll get hammered for it, but
hammer us both.
I'm not on board with her referring to the alien queen as a bitch, especially when, you know, what Ripley is trying to do is protect her young, for lack of a better word. Which is essentially what the alien queen is trying to do. You know, admittedly, they're killing humans and they're the bad guys, and I understand that, but Ripley is the one who came in and murdered all the babies. Like, she did start some shit, and so I don't know if it's totally fair, but whatever. Again, it's just a line designed to get people to stand up and cheer, and it works because people still quote it, but I totally agree with you.
Yeah, it's just kind of a lazy base sort of line that doesn't serve the movie.
He does that a lot, unfortunately.
No, absolutely. I mean, there are – I'm trying to think of a specific example in Terminator 2, but I'm sure that there are several.
Well, again, the line that we always joke about from Avatar, and I know you haven't seen it, but is Stephen Lang saying, "We are not in Kansas anymore." And Avatar takes place, I believe, hundreds of years into the future. So I find it hard to believe they are still – that their cultural reference point is still the Wizard of Oz, but maybe it is. I don't know.
Well, it's probably Oz the Great and Powerful.
But it's just so,
that's more.
It's so, like you said, lazy, you know? And so it bugs me to see a director like Cameron work so very hard at creating things that you've never seen before and editing his movies in such a way and directing them in such a way that are so intense and so action-packed and so fun and thrilling. He works so hard as a director, and then his writing can be just so very lazy, and that always bums me out.
Yeah. And maybe it's unfair to expect, you know, I don't want to excuse Cameron or Nolan, but maybe it's unfair to expect too much from, you know, people who are taking on so much to be good at everything. And, you know, I think of Christopher Nolan, I think of a great spectacle, I think of very kind of intricate you know, plots and ideas. But I also think about how his movies kind of leave me cold and how it almost seems more like an Excel spreadsheet than it does like a relatable story with characters that I can, you know, get behind. I mean, it just seems calculated and calculating and cold. And maybe that's just where his particular weak spot is. And Cameron, mm-hmm. He wants to get to that next big thing and he sees it in such big, you know, broad strokes and structures, and the house is so perfectly built that, you know, if this one curtain because I love analogies is a little bit, you know, askew, then, you know, it doesn't, that doesn't, you know, that this wall is solid. It's just this one little detail that, you know, that doesn't bother him, but bothers everyone else. I don't know. Not or me.
I mean, everyone just, else. It just ends up being so many little details, you know, because his screenplays are riddled with that kind of dialogue. And so it's frustrating that a guy who goes to that much trouble to make things as good as they can be and push things forward and always go bigger, that he isn't, I don't know if it's hubris or what, that he isn't able to step back and say, this may be a weak point for me and maybe I need to get some help or allow somebody else to step in and write. Again, I love the idea of Cameron as a writer director because we have so few auteurs who work on the scale on which he works. And so I like that in theory, but the writer side of it, you know, sells the director side a little bit short. And so sometimes I wish he would let somebody else, you know, it's that same thing that people talk about with Lucas and the Star Wars prequels. Like if the best Star Wars movies are the ones that Lucas neither wrote nor directed, you know, it's like,
right.
You got to sometimes let somebody else in and pick up the slack where your strengths may not be, but,
sure.
We all have
blind spots. We all have weaknesses, obviously.
Sure.
And I mean, James Cameron is so exacting and so kind of clear in what he wants that I can't see him giving control of anything to someone else, even if that would make, you know, this part of the movie better.
Right.
And so I think that that's just kind of what you get when you have someone who is wants to get their particular idea and vision up on screen.
Right.
And they have, you know, they have the talent and the strength to do that, to kind of show you exactly what they want. It's not going to be perfect. It's going to, you know, because it's not a collaborative, you know, process.
And me saying that, you know, Cameron's dialogue is his weak spot doesn't necessarily make it true. And James Cameron would probably beg to differ. You know, he probably doesn't see it as a source of weakness in his movies because his box office proves me wrong, you know?
Sure, and I think it ties into, you know, what you said, that the line, you know, get away from her, you bitches, is meant to get people to stand up and cheer. It does exactly what he wants it to do in that moment.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I might hate that line because it's lazy and is not, you know, not nuanced, but it's exactly, you know, the thing he wants to hit at that time. All of the Hudson stuff that he says probably has the effect that he wants at that moment. It's broad and it's not something any real person would say,
right?
But it communicates a very specific emotion or idea that he wants in that moment. And so he's not interested in, would a human being in real life say this? It's, you know, what can I use in this moment to get this one thing, you know, across, or just get this one emotion.
Right. And again, 9 out of 10 people that you talk to that are fans of the movie Aliens will end up quoting either get away from her, you bitch, or game over, man, or, you know, one of Hudson's lines. So these things that we're pointing out is like, I could do without these things. That's the thing that 9 out of 10 people love about the movie. So as much as we may feel like, oh, Cameron, you could do better, I guess he knows what he's doing because he's given people what they want.
Sure. And I've heard it, you know, I've heard various people say that, you know, the thing about a James Cameron movie is that, you know, you don't even really need, in some sense, the dialogue for it to be a movie to be understood by people who don't even speak English. You can show it in various countries around the world and people get it in its broad strokes because he's so good at showing, you know, the big thing, the big things that you can tell what's going on in the story, even if you're not, you know, getting the nuance of the dialogue.
And that was one of the things I'd said when we were emailing last week, that James Cameron really knows how movies work, and he knows how to pace things and build things and pay them off. And so even with the sound turned off, Aliens is a very thrilling movie and structured in such a way that it just keeps delivering. And that's one of the things that I love about it. And I think that's true, again, of almost all of his movies. I think even Titanic, and I definitely have a ton of problems with that movie. I think the beats in which that movie works, I think it's structured in the right way. The only movie of his for me that doesn't work on that level is again True Lies, which is still just my least favorite of his movies. But But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about aliens.
No, we're talking about aliens. And I think that I'm a lot of where I'm coming from, obviously, is where I'm coming from. I mean, this is my own. I'm bringing my own, interests and even you know, weak spots. I mean, when I'm much more interested, as a person in the details, and I have more difficult time seeing and thinking about the broad strokes, just in the way my brain works. I mean, it's true. When I write reviews, it's the thing I struggle with the most is getting the big stuff. I'm much more likely to get bogged down in details or kind of get into this one little thing that I notice. So it makes sense that I would, notice when James Cameron doesn't do the thing that I would, that I want him to do, and why I would, be more drawn to someone like Wes Anderson, who is very much about the little details and these little precious moments. So it syncs up with my, brain waves or biorhythms or, biological clock, whatever it is. I'm not sure what the exact thing is.
Yeah.
I don't know. So.
All right. Well, I guess that'll do it for Aliens. I'm actually, as much as I was interested to hear, your reasons for not liking it, I kind of knew what those reasons would be because they're the same things that I can see in the movie. I'm very aware of the movie's flaws. It's like we said, it's just that the things I like tend to overshadow them. So as much as I was interested to hear that, I'm actually really happy to hear that you enjoyed the movie more this time around.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's part of my growth as a as a film viewer is to be able to step outside of my own, ideas of what a movie should be and try to kind of see a movie from the intentions of the director or to see the strengths of James Cameron instead of just dismissing him out of hand like a silly little man.
And now you just need to see Avatar once and then wait 5 years and then see it maybe four more times and then you might start to like it. So
maybe I don't know. I'm still struggling with parts of Terminator 2. I don't know if I want to
yeah, no, there's no way you're gonna like Avatar. I want to
settle myself with Avatar right now.
There's
so.
No way you're I'm gonna
good.
Like
I look I did this. I said I liked Aliens. Can please release my puppy? That's all. I think I fulfilled our end of the contract. You've stopped recording.
Right? Yeah, no. Okay. A long time. So I actually didn't start. So.
Oh, okay. Oh, great. It's even fine. Better.
You ready to do this? Are you ready to do this for real? Now?
That was a great practice. Okay. All right. Me, my mama, moo. Me, my mama, moo. All right.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Oh, I don't know.
I'm sorry. Today's
I'm glad you haven't started recording because I'm interrupting you when you're trying to wrap up the show. Because I'm trying to give a bit over here and there's nothing. And you're just finish the show. I'm sorry. Game over, man. Show over, man.
Game over, man.
Show over.